Hello there. My name is Greg, and I'm a reader with the Talking Information Center. For the next hour, I will be reading some news headlines from the BBC World News for Tuesday, May 26, 2026. We are almost at the end of May. The first day after the Memorial Day weekend. If you were in Massachusetts, it was a rainy weekend up until yesterday afternoon. But all is good today, and tomorrow is supposed to be beautiful. Let's start in with the news and see how many stories we can cover over the next 60 minutes. The headline of the first story reads, U.S. launches new strikes on Iran, targeting missile sites and boats. The United States said it launched new strikes on southern Iran on Monday, targeting Iranian missile sites and boats attempting to place mines. These strikes were in self-defense and designed to protect our troops from threats posed by Iranian forces, U.S. Central Command said in a statement. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said on Tuesday it had downed a U.S. drone and fired at a fighter jet and another drone that entered Iranian airspace, state media reported. It did not specify when this happened. It added that Iran had the legitimate and definite right to retaliate against any U.S. ceasefire violations. U.S. forces conducted self-defense strikes in southern Iran today to protect our troops from threats posed by Iranian forces, CENTCOM spokesperson Captain Tim Hawkins said in a statement on Monday. U.S. Central Command continues to defend our forces while using restraint during the ongoing ceasefire. Captain Hawkins added that the U.S. strikes targeted an area near Bandar Abbas, a southern port city and home of the Iranian naval base that sits on the Strait of Hormuz, according to the New York Times. Iranian state media had earlier reported that local officials in Bandar Abbas were investigating after explosions were heard. It is unclear what impact the latest U.S. strikes will have on any potential peace agreement between the U.S. and Iran. Following the U.S. attack, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said a deal was still possible and pointed to talks on Tuesday between Iran's top negotiator and foreign minister and Qatar's prime minister. We'll see if we can make progress. I think it's a lot of talking back and forth going on about specific language in the initial document, so it'll take a few days, Rubio told reporters during an official visit to India. He said President Donald Trump had expressed his desire to make it. He's either going to make a good deal or no deal, Rubio said. Asked again later about Monday strikes, Rubio said the straits have to be open. They're going to be open one way or the other, so they need to be open. What's happening there is unlawful, it's illegal, it's unsustainable for the world, it's unacceptable. Meanwhile, Iran's Supreme Leader Mollahba Khamenei said the Middle East will no longer serve as shields for U.S. bases. Khamenei, who has not been seen in public since succeeding his late father as Supreme Leader earlier this year, made the comments on Tuesday in a message marking his annual Hajj pilgrimage. He added, in addition to no longer having a safe haven for evil and establishing military bases in the region, America is moving away from its previous status day by day. Earlier in May, a clash between Iran and U.S. naval destroyers in the Strait of Hormuz, for which each side blamed the other, led Trump to insist a ceasefire was still in place. At the weekend, Trump had suggested the sides were close to a deal, but later said he had instructed negotiators not to rush into one, while Rubio had said an agreement could possibly be reached on Monday. But Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Esmail Baqi responded, "It is correct to say that we have reached a conclusion on a large portion of the issues under discussion. But to say that this means the signing of an agreement is imminent, no one can make such a claim." The memorandum of understanding being discussed reportedly involves a 60-day ceasefire extension, the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, and a plan for further negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. CBS News has reported that American intelligence believes Iran's new supreme leader is holed up in an undisclosed location making communication with his envoys difficult and therefore delaying the pace of talks with the U.S. Mutaba Khamenei is thought to have been injured in an Israeli strike that killed his father and predecessor on the first day of the war more than 3 months ago. According to U.S. media, the discussions will not immediately lead to a final settlement. Contentious issues will likely be negotiated later, including details of Iranian sanctions relief, the release of foreign, frozen Iranian funds, and U.S. demands for Iran to curb its nuclear ambitions. The International Atomic Energy Agency estimated that at the start of the war, Iran had about 970 pounds of uranium enriched up to 60% purity. This is a short process away from being enriched to the weapons-grade 90%, which theoretically could allow it to create a nuclear bomb. On Monday night, Trump said the enriched uranium would either be immediately turned over to the U.S. or preferably in conjunction and coordination with the Islamic Republic of Iran, destroyed in place. U.S. and Iranian forces have observed a ceasefire since April 8th. Iran has maintained controls on Gulf shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, and the U.S. Navy has sought to blockade Iran's ports. The U.S. and Israel launched wide-ranging strikes on Iran on February 28th, sparking the conflict across the Middle East. Iran responded by attacking Israel and U.S. allied states in the Gulf and effectively closed the Strait of Hormuz. The move sent oil prices soaring globally. That's a little update on what is happening with the war with Iran. Started February 28th, so now it's 3 months, almost 3 months old, and hopefully coming to a quick conclusion. The second story, the headline reads, Ebola needs swift response to prevent a catastrophe, says the DR Congo governor. The military governor of the Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri province, the epicenter of the current Ebola outbreak, has likened the struggle to contain the spread of the virus to a war for which they are lacking resources to fight. People in affected areas are not receiving enough food, Johnny Luboya Kashama told French broadcaster RFI, adding that other diseases and overcrowding are also issues. He called for a swift response, including strengthening the capacity of staff to prevent Ituri from descending into catastrophe. Officials say there are more than 900 suspected cases of Ebola and 223 suspected deaths since the outbreak was declared on May 15th. The World Health Organization said the disease may be spreading faster than originally thought and has declared a public health emergency of international concern. On Monday, World Health Organization Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus, who is due to travel to DR Congo, has said the Ebola outbreak is outpacing urgent efforts to scale up a response, adding that responders were playing catch-up. Ebola has been reported in DR Congo's North and South Kivu provinces, as well as in neighboring Uganda, where there have been 7 confirmed cases. Elaborating on what his province needs, Kashama explained qualified personnel should be deployed as soon as possible and secure treatment centers established. Angry relatives trying to claim the bodies of loved ones who had reportedly died of Ebola have targeted 2 treatment centers. Our existing resources were dedicated to the war, and this second war that is now upon us demands even more, he said on RFI. Ituri has been under military rule since 2021, when the civilian authority was replaced by a military general in an attempt to neutralize dozens of armed groups which have operated in the area for many years. These include the Allied Democratic Forces affiliated to the Islamic State group. And lastly, we need to mobilize financial resources. They must be made available, the governor said. The more time we lose, the closer we come to a disaster. On Saturday, the head of Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention met with health ministers from DR Congo and Uganda and Southern Sudan to finalize their cross-border coordination in response to the outbreak. Africa CDC Director General Dr. Jean Kaseya said they also agreed on a $319 million budget to stop the outbreak from spreading. He told the BBC World Services Newsday on Monday that 10% of the money has been secured from the affected countries. On the same day, the South African President Cyril Ramaphosa pledged an initial $5 million to support the plan. Kaseya added that African businessmen will be meeting later this week to raise additional funds, while international partners were also committing funds. Africa CDC has warned that other countries on the continent, namely Angola, Burundi, the Central African Republic, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, South Sudan, Tanzania, and Zambia, were at risk from an outbreak. This outbreak is the 17th to have emerged in DR Congo since Ebola was discovered in 1976. It is only the third worldwide of the rare Bundingo species of Ebola, which has not been seen in over a decade. There are currently no vaccines or medications that target Bundingo, but vaccines are currently in development. Last week, the WHO said it could take up to 9 months for a vaccine to be ready. So a situation that is getting a little bit worse over in Africa as the Ebola disease seems to be spreading a bit. The headline of the next story is Gisele Pelicot deeply shocked by decision not to jail boys in a rape case. French rape survivor Gisele Pelicot has told the BBC she is deeply shocked that three teenage boys who have been spared custodial sentences over the rape of two girls in Hampshire. The girls, then aged 15 and 14, were raped in separate incidents in Fordingbridge in November 2024 and January 2025 by two 14-year-olds. Another boy, then 13, was convicted for his involvement in the second attack. The judge had said last week he wanted to avoid criminalizing the very young boys. The youth rehabilitation order sentences handed to the boys are being referred to the Court of Appeals by the Attorney General. Pelicot said she saluted the strength and courage of one of the girls for speaking out. She was speaking to the BBC after headlining this year's Hay Festival, an arts and literary festival in Wales. She told BBC Breakfast she was deeply shocked that these individuals were, in fact, able to gain their freedom again when, in fact, the victims are suffering so hard they will never be able to heal. Pelicot, 73 years old, was at the center of the biggest rape trial in French history, which saw her husband jailed for a 20-year term. Dominique Pelicot repeatedly drugged her unconscious and invited dozens of men to rape her. Rape is a crime and justice has an essential role. It's there to, in fact, name the crimes, to recognize the suffering of the victims, and to remember that, in fact, they must not remain unpunished, said Pelicot. She waived her legal right to anonymity in her own trial, saying, I want all women who have been raped to say, Madame Pelicot did it, I can too. One of the victims, who was 15 at the time of the attack, told the BBC Sunday that the decision to spare the offender's custodial sentences was like a rock straight in my face. Pelicot said she hoped her own story was useful for her to make that decision to come forward. I really salute her strength and the decision she made, because I know that it's an incredibly difficult decision, she told the BBC Breakfast. The Fordingbridge case again brought the role of social media into question after the boys shared a video of the attacks online. Pelicot called on governments big tech companies to work harder to protect victims. Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer has described the case as appalling, adding that the two girls showed extraordinary bravery and strength in heinous circumstances. He said that the Attorney General, Lord Richard Hermer, has power to refer a case to the Court of Appeals, and that power has been now exercised, which was clearly the right outcome. The sentences were given by Judge Nicholas Rowland at Southampton Crown Court. Two of the boys are now aged 15 and the third 14. One of the 15-year-olds was given a 3-year youth rehabilitation order with 180 days of intensive supervision and surveillance for the rape of each of the 2 girls and 2 indecent images charges. The other 15-year-old was given the same sentence for 3 charges of rape against each of the victims and 4 counts of taking indecent images. The 14-year-old was given an 18-month youth rehabilitation order for charges of rape in the January 25 attack by encouraging one of the other defendants. All 3 boys were also made subject to a 3-month curfew and given a restraining order for 10 years not to contact their victims. The boys would not have been sent to prison if they had been given custodial sentences. People who are under 18 serve custodial sentences in secure centers for children. In his sentencing remarks last week, Judge Rowland said, "I should avoid criminalizing these children unnecessarily and understand the effects of their behavior and support their reintegration into society." He stressed the seriousness of the crimes and said the filming of the assaults made them even more serious, but he also emphasized their very young ages. "None of you need to go to prison today," he said. Judges never publicly comment on cases they oversee, as to do so could potentially undermine, confuse, or bring into question words they have used in court. Instead, they often write sentencing remarks explaining their reasons for their ruling in court or later in writing. As per sentencing guidelines, judges must take into account the law and the view of prosecutors as to the gravity of the offending, as well as any mitigating factors presented by the defendant. Courts are expected to prioritize rehabilitation for children using custody only as a last resort. If judges have got the law or sentencing wrong, they can be held to account to the Court of Appeals. The unduly lenient sentencing scheme is a key part of that oversight. Under the scheme, anyone is allowed to ask for certain Crown Court sentences to be reviewed by the Attorney General's office if they think the sentence is too lenient. Earlier in the hearing, Judge Rowland spoke directly to one of the teenage victims and told her, "The sentence I'm about to pass cannot undo what has happened to you. I hope when you look back, you'll at least take some comfort that you, both of you, have shown great courage." One of the victims, now 16, said she and her family wanted the sentences to be changed and the boys to be sent to jail, saying the sentences amounted to a slap on the wrist. "Why did I sit and put myself through the pain of going to court, going through a trial, reliving everything because of evidence, and watching it all happen again?" the girl asked. Interesting question that she asks. The headline for the next story reads, "Netanyahu says Israel will intensify strikes against Hezbollah." Israel's military says it has begun a wave of strikes across Lebanon following an announcement by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his country will intensify its attacks on Hezbollah. The Israel Defense Forces said it had launched strikes against Hezbollah in the eastern Bekaa Valley and other parts of the country. Hezbollah, a Shia Muslim armed group in Lebanon backed by Iran, said it had retaliated by carrying out 22 drone and rocket attacks, and that its targets included Israeli soldiers, tanks, barracks, and buildings. Earlier this month, Lebanon and Israel agreed to extend a 45-day ceasefire, which began in mid-April, though attacks between Israel and Hezbollah have continued. On Tuesday morning, the IDF said it had struck more than 100 Hezbollah infrastructure sites and terrorists. 12 people are said to have been killed in an attack on the village of Mashgrara in the Bekaa Valley, Lebanese local media reported. The IDF said several strikes were conducted within seconds against Hezbollah infrastructure sites where terrorist activity was identified. It added the terrorists were eliminated during the attack. The Israeli military has issued an evacuation order for the southern town of Nabita due to possible strikes. Hours earlier, in a video statement, Netanyahu said Israel was at war with Hezbollah and the military had been told to deal them a crushing blow. Netanyahu said Israel's military offensive against Hezbollah had eliminated over 600 terrorists in the last few weeks. He continued, but what this requires of us now is to increase the strikes to increase the intensity. Two far-right Israeli ministers, Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, have called for an expansion of the military campaign, including into Beirut. Hezbollah said it had used drones and rockets to attack sites across southern Lebanon and northern Israel on Monday in response to what it called Israel's violation of the ceasefire. The Israeli authorities are particularly concerned about the use of new fiber optic drones by Hezbollah, which has been using them to strike Israeli troops now occupying a strip of land in the southern part of the country, as well as Israeli villages on the other side of the border. Officials from Lebanon and Israel, which do not have formal diplomatic relations, are due to hold further negotiations in Washington next week. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun has demanded a complete Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. Since the ceasefire agreement was signed on April 16th, Israeli attacks have been largely confined to the south of the country, where Israeli troops remain, and from where Israel says drones and rockets have been launched. The expansion of Israel's campaign came as the Iranian government insisted that an emerging peace deal with the U.S. should include a complete ceasefire on all fronts in the regional war. Israel's government has been opposed to ending the fighting against Hezbollah. 10 Israeli soldiers have been killed since the initial ceasefire with Lebanon was agreed. More than 400 people in Lebanon have been killed by heavy Israeli bombardment in the same period, including many paramedics and emergency services workers. Israel has issued near daily orders for Lebanese citizens to leave their homes in new areas in the south of the country, adding to the more than 1 million people already displaced. Lebanon was drawn into the current round of fighting after the U.S. and Israel launched a war against Iran on February 28th. Hezbollah, an ally of Iran, fired rockets into Israel in retaliation for an Israeli strike that killed the Iranian supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Israel responded with an air campaign across Lebanon and a ground invasion with more than 3,000 people killed in Israeli attacks, according to the Lebanese Ministry of Health. Lebanon's government has been pursuing attempts to disarm Hezbollah, but maintains a ceasefire is necessary in order to complete what it says is a complex task. That's a little story about a little update on what is happening with Israel on the north, where it borders Lebanon, and it is conducting a offensive against Hezbollah. The next story, the headline reads, four killed as a school minibus collides with a train in Belgium. Two children aged 12 and 15 and two adults have been killed in a collision between a train and a school minibus in Bogenhout, northern Belgium. The bus was carrying seven children, a driver 49 years old, and a chaperone 27 years old at the time of the collision, which took place shortly after 8 a.m. local time. Federal police spokeswoman Anne Berger said it had been on its way to a special education school. Belgian Mobility Minister Jean-Luc Kruk confirmed reports that the barriers on a level crossing had been down when the crash happened. The other five children who were on the bus are in critical but stable condition in the hospital, the public prosecutor's spokeswoman said. She added that an investigation has been launched into the incident. Berger said the minibus had been traveling on a street parallel to the railway, and then the driver turned left onto the level crossing while the barrier was already down. At that point, a train was heading through the small town of Bogenhout and ran into the minibus. The impact of the crash was extremely violent, as the train was traveling at about 75 miles per hour. The minibus collided with a pole before being thrown some distance into the driveway of a nearby house. Nobody on the train was hurt, although one person was being treated for shock, according to Berger. What heartbreaking news, Flemish Education Minister Zuhal Demir posted on social media My thoughts are with all of the victims, their families, and everyone closely involved. Today, Europe grieves with Belgium, said European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. The train was slowing down at the time of the collision on its approach to Bouguenhout station. Thomas Bacon, a spokesperson for Belgian rail network Infrabel, told the public broadcaster VRT. He added that the first indications from CCTV footage confirmed that the lights on the level crossing were red and the barrier was down. How this accident could have happened, we don't know. That is for the police and the public prosecutor's office to investigate, Bacon said. Another Flemish minister, Annick de Ridder, told Belgian TV it was terrible news and too early to talk of responsibility at this stage. The mayor of Bouguenhout, Gert Hermans, concluded a press conference by calling for a moment of silence to honor the victims. It's an awful story coming out of the country of Belgium this morning. We'll take a look at our neighbor to the north. The headline of this story reads, Carney says Alberta referendum is a dangerous bluff and likens it to Brexit. Prime Minister Mark Carney has called the upcoming Alberta referendum on separation from Canada a dangerous bluff, comparing it to the Brexit vote that saw the UK leave the European Union. Carney, who led the Bank of England during Brexit, said that 10 years on from the referendum, the UK was trying to undo what people didn't think they were voting for, but what they ended up having. He also cautioned against voting in favor of a separation vote as a way to strengthen Alberta's negotiating position with Ottawa, saying it may bring unintended consequences. Albertans will decide on October 19th whether they want to remain part of Canada or hold a binding vote on separation at a later date. Speaking to reporters on Monday, Carney said he will be campaigning for Canadian unity in the coming months. We have to be very careful about this, he said, adding, there is a very strong positive case for Canada, a strong Alberta, in a united Canada. Supporters of Alberta independence believe that the oil-rich province has long been overlooked by decision-makers in Ottawa, the nation's capital, and that federal environmental policies have hindered its ability to build oil and gas pipelines and develop its natural resources. The referendum comes from a grassroots independence movement, gathered more than 300,000 signatures this year for a petition calling for a vote on separation, enough to trigger a referendum. But a court decision quashed the petition after Indigenous First Nations in Alberta successfully argued that they were not properly consulted. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith said she will proceed with a referendum question on separation regardless, pointing to a separate counter-petition advocating for Alberta to remain, signed by more than 400,000 people. Smith said she disagreed with the legal decision and believed that Albertans have a right to voice their opinions in a plebiscite. Not really sure what that is. Smith has said she will campaign for Alberta to remain in Canada, saying the province's relationship with Ottawa has improved in recent months. A poll released by a Canadian firm, Angus Reid, on Monday suggests that 3 in 5 Albertans would vote for their province to remain in Canada. The Brexit vote in 2016 saw 52% of the people in the UK voting to leave, while 48% voted to remain. The UK formally left the EU in 2020. Supporters have argued that membership in the EU stifled the UK's economic growth and sovereignty. Oh, interesting story about the province up in Canada, province of Alberta, seeking to have a vote to see whether they should become independent. The next story, the headline reads, wave of child abuse cases shakes schools in Paris. A school assistant will go on trial in Paris on Tuesday, accused of sexual mistreatment of young children in his care. It is the latest case in a year-long scandal that has shaken the school system in the French capital, where some 15,000 such assistants, known as animators, are employed as non-teaching staff. Currently, inquiries are underway at nearly 100 parish creches, kindergartens, and junior schools where animators have been accused of inappropriate, aggressive, or sexualized behavior. Trials in three other cases are to take place over the summer, and a verdict is due in the fourth, which was held earlier this month. More are likely to follow. Last week, police detained 16 people after a swoop at three schools at the 7th arrondissement or district. Three people were subsequently charged with sexually inappropriate behavior to children. Tuesday's case centers on the Alphonse Bodin Junior School in the 11th arrondissement, where the animator is accused of sexualized touching with five children. One man told the BBC that in April 2025, he had already spotted unusual signs in his four-year-old daughter when another parent reported that their child had been molested. My wife took our daughter into the garden and asked her if she had been touched in after-school time, and she said, "Yes, David touches me and gives me cuddles." My wife said, "Show me," and my daughter started stroking her back in a bizarre way. That's when we knew something was wrong. The scandal has created a climate of mistrust and fear among parents of young children in Paris, many of whom accuse the city hall, which employs the animators, of failing initially to take the complaints seriously. According to After School Association SOS Paris, the main problem has been the low quality of animators who are poorly paid and at most need only a basic certificate in child management to get a job. Sometimes the pressure to recruit is so great that even that requirement is waived. Elizabeth Guthman, who founded the association in 2021, said it was in response to the growing number of stories circulating among parents about teasing, taunting, and other types of low-level abuse by the animators. She cited a case of four animators at a junior school in the 16th arrondissement who set up a fight club with the other children standing around shouting, "Hit him!" The new mayor of Paris, Emmanuel Gregoire, has vowed to reform the recruitment system with a 20 million euro fund for training and monitoring. He said animators would be automatically suspended after a single complaint had been lodged. Since the start of the year, nearly 80 have been suspended. The animators, most of whom are on short-term contracts, are expected to look after young children during meals time and in the afternoon after classes finish. They are supposed to conduct various sporting, craft, and leisure activities. But the assistants say they themselves are now the victims of generalized suspicion and discrimination because of the scandal. Last week, they staged a strike to call for recognition and more investment in their profession. Parents have, so to speak, taken power over the schools and started reporting things. Except that not everything they report is necessarily accurate, said Carla Bonnet of the FO Union. City Hall is no longer objective, said Remy, an after-school assistant. It doesn't investigate the allegations. It doesn't look after us. Working with children today, at the drop of a hat, you can be accused of absolutely anything. When you have a system in which workers aren't properly paid or trained or monitored, and where there's no money or proper procedures for raising the alert, it's not surprising that things get out of control, said Gregoire Ensel of the parents' organization FCPE. The scandal has been centered on Paris, but activists say that similar problems exist across the entire country. So kind of a disturbing story there to come out of the, looks like the school assistants who run the after-school programs in Paris. The next story, the headline reads, China executes a man for murdering a prominent gaming tycoon. Chinese authorities have executed a man for murdering his associate, billionaire gaming tycoon Lin Kui. In 2020, a disgruntled Zhu Yao poisoned Lin for sidelining him shortly after he helped him land a Netflix deal, local media reported. Lin's Yuzu Games, holds the film adaptation rights for the Chinese science fiction trilogy, which Netflix made into the series Three Body Problem. Zhu was convicted in 2024, and his execution, which reportedly happened on May 21st, was confirmed on Tuesday by his company in a statement, adding, "Justice has ultimately been served. We deeply mourn Mr. Lin and extend our heartfelt condolences to his family," the statement said. "As colleagues who fought alongside him, all members of the company are grateful for the impartiality of the judicial process." The science fiction trilogy, Three Body Problem, is based on Chinese author Liu Zixin's Remembrance of Earth's Past. First published in Chinese, the books have been translated into nearly 30 languages and inspired multiple adaptations. The Netflix adaptation in 2024 quickly became one of the streaming platform's most watched shows. Lin was posthumously credited as one of its executive producers. That same year, Zhu was convicted of Lin's murder, with the court describing his plot as extremely despicable. Lin's death came as a shock to the gaming industry in China and beyond. Lin is the founder of Yuzu Games, the Shanghai-based developer best known for the Game of Thrones Winter is Coming strategy game. In 2018, Lin appointed Zhu to lead Three Body Universe, a subsidiary to manage projects related to the science fiction franchise. But they fell out in 2020 when Lin decided to put other executives in charge of business operations. After that, Zhu disguised lethal substances as probiotic pills and gave them to Lin. In December 2020, Lin went to the hospital after feeling unwell. He died 9 days later at the age of 39. At the time, he was believed to have had a net worth of about $941 million, according to the Hurun China Rich List. Police arrested Zhu days after Lin was hospitalized. Besides Lin's death, Zhu's poisoning plot also left several others sick. Chinese newspaper Economic Observer reported on Tuesday that one of Zhu's victims had written on social media, "Justice comes in the end, even if it's too late." So, interesting story about business partners who certainly fell out of favor with each other. Let's see what we've got here. So this story headline reads, "Morocco wants tourists to visit Western Sahara, but some say it's tightening control." Back in May, an email landed in my inbox from Irish airline Ryanair, asked me if I was ready for my next Moroccan adventure. Sprawling along a windswept peninsula where the Sahara meets the Atlantic, the city of Dakhla certainly looked attractive. I would have to make my way to Madrid first, but from the Spanish capital, returned flights to Dakhla started at just 30 euros. There are dozens of accommodation options, too, from hostels to brand new luxury getaways, advertising the area as Morocco's hidden gem. But despite what the advertisements and websites say, any tourist making the trip would be landing in one of the world's longest ongoing territorial disputes. That is because Dakhla is in Western Sahara, an area which the United Nations classified as a non-self-governing territory. By this, it means that the local population is not able to govern itself. Instead, some 80% of Western Sahara is occupied and administered by Morocco, its northern neighbor. Morocco considers Western Sahara to be part of its sovereign territory, calling it its southern provinces. The UN has consistently pushed for a solution to the 50-year dispute, including a referendum, but the indigenous people of the area have never been able to vote for their own future. Rights groups and legal experts tell the BBC that marketing and labeling Western Sahara as part of Morocco raises serious concerns from an international law perspective and promotes the legitimization of Morocco's occupation. The Moroccan government has not responded to a request for comment. Visitor numbers to Morocco-controlled Western Sahara have risen by more than 50% over the past 7 years, data from the Moroccan Ministry of Tourism shows. They jumped from 490,000 in 2019 to 743,000 in 2025. The boom is being fueled by expanding air links. Alongside Morocco's national carrier, Royal Air Maroc, airlines include Ryanair, Transavia France, and Blinter Canaris now operate direct routes from Madrid, Paris, and the Canary Islands, respectively. Tom Ruck is one UK tourist who recently flew to Dakhla from Madrid with Ryanair. "You've got quite a lot of resorts being built, however, they were very, very, very empty," he said. Ruck adds that there were a few other tourists knocking about for a summer family holiday kind of thing, but it definitely felt like it was in its infancy. He got a Moroccan stamp in his passport and says that Morocco's flag flies across the city. It comes as the Moroccan government has invested heavily in developing tourism in Western Sahara in recent years. This has attracted the airlines, with both Ryanair and Transavia France listing destinations within Western Sahara as being part of Morocco. Transavia France tells the BBC the firm operates flights to Dakhla in accordance with the authorizations received from the authorities. Ryanair has not responded to a request for comment. However, Binter Canaris, the flag carrier of Spain's autonomous Canary Islands, bucks the trend, calling the area Western Sahara. It operates flights to Dakhla, as well as the territory's biggest city, Laayoune. Eric Hagen of the campaign group Western Sahara Research Watch says airlines referring to the territory as Morocco is both concerning and misleading. When companies market destinations there as Moroccan, they risk contributing to a distortion of international law and public understanding. He adds that this raises serious questions about corporate responsibility and due diligence in politically sensitive and illegally occupied territories. When you search for a place to stay in Western Sahara on three of the biggest international booking sites, Expedia, Booking.com, and Trivago, they also call the location of the hotels as being in Morocco. A spokesperson for Booking.com says if a particular region can be categorized as disputed or impacted by conflict, we add information to our platform to help ensure that travelers can make a well-informed choice. It said this is done by, quote, advising them to consult their government's official travel advisories as part of their decision-making process. Our approach is consistent globally. Expedia declined to comment, and Trivago has been approached for a statement. Dr. Andrea Maria Pellicconi, an expert in international human rights law at the University of Southampton, says airlines and booking sites should distinguish Western Sahara as a territory with a different status from Morocco. She adds it's possible that companies that fail to make this distinction will face litigation not only for violating international law and the Sahrawis, the indigenous people's right to self-determination, but also for issues relating to consumer protection and related information rights and fair compensation rules under EU law. Pressure from campaign groups has led to some change. Last year, Airbnb stopped referring to listings in Western Sahara as being in Morocco. Western Sahara was a Spanish colony from 1884 to 1976. When Spain pulled out, Morocco claimed the territory. An armed conflict soon broke out between Morocco and Sahrawis fighters, who formed the Polisario Front, demanding an independent Western Sahara. A ceasefire brokered by the UN in 1991 included plans for a referendum on self-determination, but that vote has never taken place. Today, the Polisario Front controls a narrow eastern strip of the country. The Polisario Front's representatives to the UK and Ireland, Sidi Breika, says tourism is being used to impose a fait accompli to Morocco's claim. He adds that most tourists visiting are not well informed about the whole issue. All projects are being carried out in the territory under illegal occupation violate the inalienable rights of the Sahrawi people to self-determination and independence clearly recognized by the UN. Breca adds that Polisario was watching Ryanair closely and considering legal action. In October, the UN Security Council voted in favor of prioritizing Morocco's plan to make Western Sahara an autonomous region as the most likely way forward. It also extended the presence of the UN peacekeeping mission in Western Sahara for another 12 months. The motion was led by the U.S., who under President Trump in 2020 agreed to recognize Morocco's claim over the Western Sahara in return for Morocco recognizing Israel. Despite these developments, the international legal position still stresses the need for a mutually agreed political solution under UN supervision. The Polisario Front has also repeatedly rejected the autonomy proposal. Breca remains defiant. We hope Morocco understands that investing in tourism or any other economical projects does not replace the will of the Sahrawi people and its inalienable right to decide its future. So that's kind of an interesting story. I didn't realize what was going on there, to be quite honest. Next story, the headline reads, Delhi's most exclusive club is under the threat of shutdown. Can it survive? In India's capital of Delhi, power has long circulated through ministries, embassies, and the parliament, but also through the shaded verandas of the Gymkhana Club. For generations, the cream-colored clubhouse, located on Saffron Road, has functioned as a discreet world of retired generals, senior bureaucrats, and old business families, conducting negotiations over whiskey sodas and kebabs. Even those who have never entered its gates, which is most Delhi residents, have heard stories about its grandeur. Now that world faces an uncertain future. Last week, the federal government, which owns the 27.3 acres on which the 113-year-old club stands, ordered it to vacate by June 5th, saying the land is needed for defense infrastructure and other vital public security purposes. In its notice, the government called the area a highly sensitive and strategic zone near the prime minister's residence and said the lease stood terminated with immediate effect. Members have challenged the order in court, and the Delhi High Court heard the case on Tuesday. The federal government told the court that it would not immediately take over the land on June 5th, and any eviction action would be taken only after giving the club a notice under the law. The judge said that the club, its staff and members could then come back to the court to challenge the eviction. The government's action against the club follows years of scrutiny of elite institutions by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government and has reignited debates about privilege, heritage, and public space. But it has also triggered an unexpected wave of nostalgia, with some Delhi residents expressing affection for a place they often claimed to despise. The Gymkhana is expensive to join, but access has long been controlled more by gatekeeping than price. Applicants must be proposed and seconded by members, after which a managing committee approves them. The process has traditionally favored senior civil servants and defense officers, with a smaller share for others. Critics say this has helped sustain inequality, even as it has made the Gymkhana one of Delhi's most sought-after memberships. But many recall how the place kept alive a fragment of Delhi's elite past through small rituals. Liveried waiters at dusk, gin and lime on shaded verandas, retired generals and diplomats lingering under the neem trees. A Delhi-based senior journalist who never had a membership told the BBC the club always felt distant. But now I feel like I'm stepping in once. It is one of the few structures in Delhi that has remained untouched, while the city outside has changed completely. Founded in 1913 as the Imperial Delhi Gymkhana Club, it emerged alongside the making of Delhi after the British shifted India's capital from Calcutta. It first operated from the coronation grounds in civil lines, serving British ambassadors and military officers before being allotted its present site on Samfering Road in 1928. The current clubhouse, designed in the 1930s by British architect Robert Tor Russell, who also designed the iconic Connaught Place, reflects the architecture of early central Delhi with its deep verandas, high ceilings, and pale facades opening into trees and lawns. Inside, time seemed to move differently. Tennis whites drying beneath the afternoon sun, bridge rooms carrying the faint smell of cigarettes and talcum powder, elderly members reading newspapers beneath slow ceiling fans. History lingered there in intimate ways. In its early decades, westernized Indian civil service officers, among the few Indians admitted into elite colonial circles, reportedly learned ballroom dancing and British social etiquette at the club as they navigated the codes of imperial society. In 1947, as the British Indian Army was divided between India and the newly created Pakistan, officers from regiments about to be separated gathered at the door for farewell drinks before history placed them on either side of the border. That image, officers sharing one final evening together, helps explain why the possible closure of the Gymkhana feels so emotional to so many in Delhi. Places like these become repositories of memory, carrying traces of different eras inside them. Cities are layered entities. Different generations leave their mark on them, said historian Narayani Gupta. During the final years of British rule and the early decades after independence, the club remained closely connected to the capital's political life. Speaking at the Gymkhana's centenary celebrations in 2013, then-President Pranab Mukherjee recalled that Mahatma Gandhi and Lord Irwin, then Viceroy of India, had met privately there, leading to what became known as the Gandhi-Irwin Pact. After 1947, Imperial was dropped from the club's name, but much of the atmosphere remained. Dress codes, old carpets, evening drinks, and familiar waiters serving generations of the same families. Over time, the Gymkhana has become the shorthand for a certain kind of inherited privilege in Delhi. Its notoriously long waiting list, often stretching across decades, became part of city folklore, which, while critics saw the club as a symbol of influence shaped by personal networks and family legacy. A retired Indian Police Service officer told the BBC it took him 18 years to get a membership. "When I applied, I was fascinated by the idea," he said. "By the time I became one, I was totally indifferent and rarely visited it." Ghazal Tansir, a Delhi-based doctor who first visited the club for her wedding reception in 2019 through a relative's membership, described it as a preserved, undisturbed little nook of memories. That exclusivity increasingly came under scrutiny after Modi's government came to power in 2014, promising to shift power away from Delhi's long-established English-speaking elite. Following inspections in 2016 and 2019, the Ministry of Corporate Affairs approached a government tribunal in 2020, alleging financial irregularities and violations of membership rules at the club. 2 years later, the tribunal dissolved the club's governing committee and allowed the government to appoint administrators in its place, a move that drew criticism from some members. The latest eviction order has once again divided opinion. Kiran Bedi, a former top police officer who was once the chief ministerial candidate for Delhi from Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, called it unfortunate and tragic, describing Gymkhana as part of the capital's sporting and institutional heritage. Historian Swapana Little acknowledged the club's elitist origins, but said she would have preferred efforts to reform the institution rather than shut it down. Instead of just saying, "Let it not exist," you, the government, could have asked how it could be changed and made meaningful for more people. Others took a different view. Journalist Prabhu Chawali criticized the clubs like the Gymkhana as exclusionary institutions operating on heavily subsidized public land. Former diplomat K.C. Singh, however, said that such clubs historically gave civil servants and military officers affordable recreational spaces despite modest government salaries. BJP spokesperson R.P. Singh rejected the suggestions that the government was unfairly targeting the club. "It is a property leased by the government," he told the BBC. "Everything has happened according to the rulebook and relevant laws." Beneath the legal and political arguments, however, runs a more emotional response, one tied to memory and loss in a city that is constantly changing. So, interesting story from India about the future of a club that seems to cater to the rich and probably famous in India. So we are about a minute away from the end of our hour, probably too late to start another story. If you're a sports person and you like the NBA, you might be watching the playoffs right now, and the New York Knicks last night completed a four-game sweep of the Cleveland Cavaliers, so they are going to be in the NBA Finals, and the other finalist will come from the Western Conference, and right now the Oklahoma Thunder and the San Antonio Spurs are tied up 2-2 in what has been a great series so far. So that series, I think, proceeds again tonight. If you're a Red Sox fan, I think you're in for a long season. They have very little offense, and depending on pitching and defense, and it's tough to continually depend on pitching and defense. It has to be almost perfect every night. They seem to have trouble scoring runs. But what can you do when you let players like Alex Bregman leave the team? So we have reached the end of our hour together. I want to first thank you for listening to the stories that I've elected to read. I hope you have found them to be entertaining, enjoyable, and interesting. I look forward to reading the news with you again in the near future. Until we have a chance to do that again, I hope that life gives you many reasons to smile. Be well, my friends.